Session number 4653.
This is Grindley Reel 2. Who were mainly involved in the business of converting the Indian quarters into a hospital?
The people that were there, the nurses and the staff from Queen Mary. Dr. Hackett and the people from the prison hospital, I believe, came out and gave a hand to getting it all organised. That was before we actually got any casualties. Mm-hmm. But once the casualties started coming in, the two helpers from the hospital went back inside the jail, and then there was no contact between the jail and the hospital until after the 25th December.
I see. There must have been some problems involved in this conversion process. What were the main ones?
Just make do. That was the only thing you could do. There was just nothing else for it. You just had to make do with what you'd got. Unfortunately, I was on night duty, so I really wasn't that much involved with the incoming of the patients and what happened during the day, the feeding or anything like that. All I know is at night time all the poor things wanted was water, and as most of them had been shot in the stomach, they weren't allowed water. It wouldn't have made any difference anyway because they died.
What size of hospital was set up?
Oh,
I'm interested, you know, in the number of beds.
Yes, well, I should
staff.
Say about 60 beds all told. That was about the limit. There was no more. There couldn't have been any more than that.
Now, cast your mind back to the moment the casualties began to arrive, and tell me what you can remember about the number of casualties, the kinds of injuries, what was going on in the hospital at that time.
Most of them were stomach wounds, and Dr. Hackett was taking off arms and legs with no real equipment. There were no such things as blood transfusions or anything like that. One poor man had gangrene. He'd been out on the hillside for days and his leg had gone bad. He eventually died, and that's all there was. They just died, and you couldn't do anything for them. It was heartbreaking, because they were all so young. I don't suppose any of them were above about 18, and some of them didn't even know their names. Mm. I think that affected me more than it did the actual injuries, was seeing all this young lads being just wasted. Because it was waste, because nothing anybody did saved Hong Kong. And they said, oh, you must stand and it'll help Singapore, but it didn't.
How would you describe the conditions in the hospital?
Pretty primitive, absolutely. But there you are, it was so... There were so many people and patients milling around that I don't know how they ever got any order out of the chaos.
Can you give me any more examples to illustrate the grimness in the hospital?
Only in when all the bodies were piled up outside each morning.
Oh, now tell me that from, you know, the beginning of someone would die and what would happen. Could you tell me that as a story?
As they died, they were just piled up outside because there were so many of them and there was nobody to bury them. It was this Reverend Martin who eventually... The Indians had gardens down on the slope leading down to the sea, and he just dug graves and buried them all there.
On his own?
On his own. He was an old man, but he was a marvellous man. Of course, and afterwards they had the military cemetery there, and I think they all put them all there eventually.
All right. You explained to me that after a period you moved from Tweed Bay and set up a new hospital. Why?
Well, the Japanese came and took all the military personnel away, and the jail authorities asked if they could take their own wounded into the jail hospital. And as our husbands were in the hospital, the Japanese agreed to that. I don't think they knew what to do with us anyway. They hadn't got the They hadn't got the people organised in Hong Kong to come out and make Stanley a camp. So we were put into the jail and we stayed there.
I'm still thinking about the hospital side of things.
In the jail?
Yes. So
well,
when,
we carried,
you, when you moved to the jail, then you had the same problem all over again.
No, that was an established hospital. Everything was there, all the equipment, the operating theatre, and everything was there. But there were no need for any operations. We just had to nurse and the people that were there. It was our own people. They were all warders that were in the jail hospital that had been transferred from Tweed Bay.
With the division of military and civilian personnel, what kinds of casualties did you have left on your hands?
One man was shot through the foot, another man shot through the arm. I suppose you'd call them pretty minor casualties, really, that the jail people had. One man got married in his hospital bed.
You've explained to me in general terms what your nursing duties were. Were there any highlights of that nursing period, any particular incidents that stand out that you...
Just the cutting off of the arms and legs and the dead bodies outside. They are the two things that I don't think I'll ever forget.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit now because I'd like to finish with the hospital side of things. Did the Stanley Jail Hospital remain the hospital centre for Stanley when it became an internment camp?
No. The Japanese took over the jail and they had their own prisoners in there and it was nothing to do with the camp at all. Nothing at all. The Tweed Bay opened up again then and that was the hospital for the internees because they had all the professors and all the top staff from all the hospitals, Kowloon Hospital, Queen Mary, the lot.
And
Tweed Bay was the hospital for the internees.
From the point where you ceased to have the hospital in the jail?
That's right, yes.
Throughout
yes.
the rest of the
That's
war?
That's right, yes.
Okay, fine. Again, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but throughout the internment period, up till the end of the war, what was the general physical condition of internees like?
Pretty poor. People seemed to go down, once they started to go downhill, they went very fast. As I told you, some of the men just gave up. They just didn't want to know and they just lay down and died, literally. The women, I think, were more active than the men, except for the police, of course, they were always around and about because they were younger. The older men didn't stand up to it too well. Morale, pretty good, but people that you would least expect. Sorry, am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I'm just still thinking about health and things. You explained what it was like generally. What were the particular health problems?
Dysentery and beriberi. They were the two main things. And of course, the children suffered badly. I mean, the children shouldn't have really been there, but there you are. Somehow or other, they hadn't been evacuated. And they had to be taken care of. So any extras that came into the jail in the way of, sometimes we had bananas, not enough to go all round the camp, so they were kept for the children and the invalids. They had their clinics. People said, you know, they were could take the children there if they were suffering from anything, and they would be given extra food if there was any.
Dysentery and beriberi, how widespread?
Very widespread, especially in the beginning. I think it was the transition from normal food to rice, and people's stomachs just couldn't take it.
When you say very widespread, what do you mean exactly?
I should say 75% of the camp had dysentery. And of course then the beriberi came later. And that affected... About 50%, I should imagine. Some more badly than others.
What treatment was available for dysentery?
Epsom salts. Drastic. But sometimes it worked, but sometimes it didn't. And I mean, they were so, some people were just so dehydrated that they died. And there was nothing you could do about it. They used to give us, they made yeast from sweet potato peelings and little sugar. That was supposed to counteract, not the dysentery, but it was supposed to counteract the beriberi. But of course that aggravated the dysentery. Being yeast and working, of course, that made things a lot worse.
That's very interesting. Was that the yeast, was that the only treatment available for beriberi?
That and soya beans, which was supposed to be vitamin B. It didn't do much good. And I think they had shark's liver oil. That was given to the children. How that came in, I don't know. I suppose the Japanese sent it in. If they came across anything that they didn't want, they used to send it in to the internees. But shark's liver oil was very good for curing ulcers. Some people had these tropical ulcers, and they would dress them with shark's liver oil, and it was very, very good.
Gosh, I never knew that.
Mm. I believe cod liver oil will do the same thing. But of course, we didn't have that.
Yes. These treatments that were available for dysentery and beriberi, such as they were, did they cure?
Cured me? Yeah, it did. Yes, it did. In a large number of cases, it did cure the dysentery. Because after all, it was only a bug, and you'd just got to get that bug out of your system, and that was the way they did it. And once it was gone, the majority of people didn't get it again. I didn't get it anymore anyway.
To what extent were dysentery and beriberi kept under control?
I think they did very well in keeping it down as far as they did. But as I told you, they had the odd case, mostly the elderly women and the elderly men. They just couldn't take it and they went.
Mm. Did the conditions have different effects, like dysentery and beriberi, did they have different effects on different people? I mean, like men and women, for example. Did you react differently to these?
Yes, I told you, the men went thin and the women got fat. Some of the women were absolutely colossal, but it was all water. If you pressed your finger into their leg, it left a dent, and it took a while for that to come out. But as there was only rice to eat, and rice was the cause of beriberi, what did you do? You just had to eat it.
What caused the fatness, the beriberi?
The water. See, rice is mainly water, starch, and that set up the water, and that was the beriberi.
Were there any theories about why the men didn't get fat?
I don't think so. I think everybody was so concerned with their own little things that I don't really think they didn't go into that.
Now, originally, when the Japanese arrived in Hong Kong, you were living in a flat in Gap Road.
No. When I was single, I lived in Gap Road, but after I was married, I went to live at Stanley, and I had married quarters there. From the married quarters...
Yes. Well, now, so tell me about the married quarters. What kind of accommodation did you and your husband have?
Oh, very nice. Sitting room, dining room, one large bedroom, bathroom, toilet, and outside was the armour's quarters. But after the Japanese came, then we moved down to Tweed Bay, and that was dormitory accommodation.
Yes. So the married quarters in Stanley that you originally occupied, after the Japanese arrived, how long were you allowed to remain in them?
It started on the 9th of December. I think we went down to Tweed Bay on about the 23rd of December. So in that time I was living in my own flat, and I also had another person and a newborn baby was billeted on me for a short while. Mm. And we had supplies of food, which we'd always kept in case of typhoon, so we had plenty of our own food.
Now, what actually happened as far as the first move was concerned?
That was after I was in the house by myself and I was shelled. And I got frightened. and I went over to the other people in the other block of flats. They were all huddled together, and it was then that we all decided that the best thing to do would be all to go into the Tweed Bay Hospital where we'd all be together.
I see. And when you moved into Tweed Bay Hospital, describe for me in as much detail as you can remember what your conditions of accommodation were there.
We had a dormitory, one of the small Indian dormitories we converted for ourselves. We had just the ordinary, just a bed, nothing more, bed and washing facilities, and that was all. I can't even remember eating, to tell you the truth. I wouldn't know what we ate. All I know is on Christmas Day we had hard biscuit and a slice of bully beef. And that's the only thing that I can really remember.
Can you remember whether it was crowded or not?
Well, it was crowded because there were so many of us from the flats. You see, there were ARP people as well. Jail people, mind you, but that had been with the ARP, they were all in together. We'd all got in there for safety.
Was there anything you were able to do with your fellow dormitory dwellers to make the place more comfortable?
Didn't have time. Didn't have time at all. 23rd we were down there, 25th capitulation. Then the Japanese came and sorted us all out.
How did they do that?
Well, people from the jail went into the jail. And the military personnel were taken into Hong Kong. I don't know what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. And when you moved into the jail, what sort of accommodation did you have?
Well,
there?
We were allowed two cells, one for sleeping in and one for washing ourselves. So my husband and I shared, that's when we met up again after the 25th, we met up again in the jail. And then they set one block, what was called the European block. That was set aside for all the people that were transferred into the jail.
So you were living in the jail in two cells.
That's right.
Describe the cells to me.
Oh, a very small room, 8 by 6. And we managed to get two camp beds in, L-shaped. And I think we had a suitcase there in one. And in the other, we kept a bowl of water and what soap we had, and used that for, that was the same size, and used that for our washing.
I see. There was one very important question that I forgot to ask you. Mm. When you had to move out of your flat, what were you able to take with you?
I just took a small suitcase with the silver that my mother and father had given me for my 21st birthday, a change of underwear and one dress, and I think that's all I had. I took that into Tweed Bay with me, transferred it into the jail, but then afterwards, while we were working in the jail, the Japanese allowed us to go back to our flat, and that is when we picked up everything that we thought might be useful, including our store of food.
What sort of things did you pick?
Mostly valuables. I'd been given some very nice wedding presents, sterling silver spoons and all that sort of thing, cutlery, plates, crockery. That's the sort of thing that we took. Anything that we thought might be useful, we took into the jail with us. Unfortunately, we didn't get it all out, but still, that's beside the point.
With the from your later experiences in the internment camp, do you think you made the best choice?
Yes, I think I did, yes.
Why?
Yes. Because I was able to sell it. I was able to sell it to buy food.
Okay. We're going back to the two cells you occupied,
yes,
in the jail. Was there anything you were able to do to them to make them a little homely?
Yes, we took in, as we were allowed to go back to the flats, we'd brought in a mattress, a pillow, blankets, most valuable blankets, and we also brought in woolen rugs to put, because they were cement floors, and it was December and it was jolly cold.
Any other little touches?
Well, we had our own crockery and spoons. Everything that was useful we had gradually collected together.
Now, the next move with Mr. Grindley, I believe, was into the Indian married quarters.
That's right, yes.
Why did you have to move yet again?
Well, the Japanese wanted the jail for their own purposes. They had already filled all the flats up, as far as we could see, with Europeans. But we weren't allowed out at that time. But as I told you, one morning at 12 o'clock, we were told, you will be out of the jail within half an hour. So we just took out what we could. My husband said, we can't take anything, they're going to put us in Hong Kong. I said, I don't care what we're going to do, we're going to get as much out as we can. If we leave it at the main gate, we leave it. So luckily we were able to carry all our stuff down to the Indian quarters.
I have this vision of you just loaded up with...
I was literally. You could have seen my husband and I lugging this great camphorwood chest along the road. And as we were going, the executioner came down the road. And of course we all had to drop everything and bow. And I couldn't get that case away because they were threatening us with all sorts. Because we weren't supposed to take anything out. But we got away with it.
They let it pass.
They let it pass, yes.
Describe to me the whole episode of moving into the Indian married quarters.
Oh, it was terrible. There were 10 of us, 9. There were 4 married couples and 1 single girl. She was a Eurasian wardress. And we finally, I think there were 4 in one and 5 in the other room. And of course then we had to walk for our food. That was when Salvation Army set up the communal kitchen in the garages. We had to walk. Most of the time was spent queuing for your food. Mm. We only got 2 meals a day.
Stay for a moment
with the accommodation.
With the business of this move into the Indian quarter.
Very, very small, 2 very, very small rooms with a native kitchen and a native toilet, which was terrible because it had 2 feet on the side. And you had to squat right down. I'm afraid lots of people fell. I mean, it sounds funny now, but it wasn't funny then.
Now, I'm a little bit confused about this. You moved into the Indian married quarters, and you moved into 2 rooms.
That was the accommodation for an Indian and his wife and family. They were given 2 rooms, kitchen and toilet.
And
a tap, and that was all.
And how many of you moved into these 2 rooms?
9 of us moved into these 2 rooms.
How did that compare with the 2 cells in the jail?
Oh, it was terrible.
Why?
We had to sleep on cement floor. We didn't have any mattresses. We just had to... We'd taken out blankets with us, so we slept in blankets on a cement floor. Until gradually, I don't know how these things happened, but gradually things came out of the jail and... We managed to get a single mattress and we both slept on that for the rest of the time.
Did you manage to get along okay with your 7 other colleagues,
well,
or were there any difficulties?
Yes, there were difficulties because I had managed to get out a small suitcase of food and it was up on a shelf and stupidly, I, trusting everybody, we had to do some cooking for ourselves. People, we'd sort of pooled everything, and every so often I'd say, well, I've got a tin of corned beef. Used to boil up the rice and mix this 1 tin of corned beef in with it, and then we all used to share the meal. But I found when I finally went to my case that this person who had taken over the cooking, he had been helping himself, and the case was empty of food.
So that must have caused a lot of...
That wasn't very nice at all. Yeah. I don't think I ever spoke to that man after that.
Were there any other incidences of that kind where people's possessions were...
Oh, gracious, yes. There was all sorts of things happening like that, especially where food was concerned. Everybody's idea was food. That was the main topic of conversation and thought.
Mm. Now, there was one... final move, I think, wasn't there?
Yes, after the Americans were repatriated, Major Wilcox contacted Mr. Jimson and asked if he would approach the Japanese and see if the jail people could have the clubhouse back. And they agreed, and then we moved up and we were lucky to have one room for ourselves. Mm-hmm. That was luxury then, because we'd managed to get trestles and planks of wood, and on that we put our mattress and we had a bed. And we had a wardrobe as well, because there had been the European single officers' quarters. So we were very lucky. We had a wardrobe. We didn't have anything to put in it.
Any other little homely touches you have?
Yes, I had my camphor wood box. I had the bed one end. I had the camphor wood box at the bottom, and the wardrobe was at the side. And I also had the clock hanging on the wall, which I'd been given as a wedding present, and I've still got it now.
Now, these quarters became available, the clubhouse, because the Americans had been repatriated.
Yes, and the clubhouse had been occupied by the single male Americans.
Yes. So there were a lot of moves and changes during the early period. How long did all this take, and when did it begin to settle down a bit?
I should imagine about 2 years before it really settled down, because I can't remember when the Americans were evacuated, or repatriated rather. I just can't remember that. But things after they went, then I think it settled down, because we realised then that there was going to be no repatriation for us anyway, so we just had to stick it out.
I gather that the Americans weren't altogether the most
not
popular.
Not terribly popular, no. They used to somehow get stuff, food, again, there you are, you see, food. They were getting all sorts of things. They had frying doughnuts and things like that while we were on rice. Didn't go down very well at all. They got flour, all sorts of things. I don't know how, but there you are, they did.
Good. Could you make it as clear to me as possible what the final pattern of arrangements were for the internment camp at Stanley itself, by just giving me a general description of the Stanley camp area, the layout, what the areas were used for, this kind of thing?
The houses on the top of the hill, they were occupied by the Japanese guards and the commandant of the camp. What we called E block was the Dutch block. That was where the Dutch and the Norwegians, and I think there was one French family, they occupied that. Down below was the Indian quarters. Well, that was all sorts occupied there. St. Stephen's College was occupied by the police, and the general jail married quarters were occupied by all the civilians from Hong Kong. As I say, and the jail people, the married jail people, were in the what we called the American block.
And the single people?
Oh, they were all churned up with everybody, because every available space was occupied. Each armour's room, because each flat had two armour's rooms. And if you could get an armour's room, you were away. But the policy was for married people, as far as possible, to be given a room to themselves. And for married people, single people, to share the larger rooms.
Was there any policy of keeping people of one nationality altogether?
No, none at all, no.
I see. So whether you were married or whether you were single, you could be mixed up.
You could be mixed, but as I say, the Dutch and the Norwegians preferred to live in their own block. So they were the people they kept to themselves. But the Eurasians, well, there was only Eurasians and British, and I mean, they just all moved in together.
Yes. And the Americans, and up till the time they left,
they kept to themselves.
In the
Yes. Yes, the missionaries had a block to themselves, and the single American men had a block to themselves.
Yes. Now, after Stanley sort of settled down a bit as an internment camp, Was the prison, did the prison continue to be used as a prison?
Only for the Japanese. Well, there was only Chinese prisoners. But I don't think they kept many prisoners. They what disposed of them.
Yes. So the jail ceased to function.
The jail ceased. Jail was nothing. No, the Japanese ran the jail for themselves, but it was nothing to do with the camp. Nothing at all.
When they first took over the Stanley area, and there were inmates in the jail, what did they do with them?
They kept them there. But as I told you, they disposed of two of the people. They were life prisoners. They disposed of those. They were the two that were hanged upside down for so many hours and then executed.
What? Why?
Because they picked a lock with a chopstick. That was a favourite game of them. They thought they were being clever, but they weren't.
They tried to escape.
Yes. Yeah.
I see. And the part of Stanley occupied by the Japanese?
Way up on the hill.
Yes.
There were three houses up there. Formerly, the doctor, the superintendent and the commissioner occupied those three houses, and they were the ones that the Japanese took over.